Hey friends, before we dive in, my new book, Sowing a Hidden Seed, Daily Prayers for Your Child's Spiritual Growth, is out now, available on intentionalparents.org exclusively, so go check that out. Christmas is coming. What a great Christmas present to get your family praying. And don't miss our upcoming retreats, the Intentional Fatherhood Retreat, February 19 through 21, 2026, in Costa Mesa, California, and the Intentional Motherhood Retreat. We announced this April 23rd through 25th, 2026 in Franklin, Tennessee. Please come out and know that early bird pricing is on both of those events, so check that out. These retreats are spaces to pause, breathe, and invest in your spiritual formation as a parent. So learn more, get your tickets now at intentionalparents.org, and let's get into this week's episode. Welcome to the Intentional Parents Podcast. Intentional exists to help parents in their God-given task to raise passionate Jesus followers. We exist to bring hope, help, and healing to families. Each week, we will talk about anything from parenting, marriage, lifestyle, and what it looks like to follow Jesus in our time. Intentional is made up of Phil and Diane Comer and Brooke and Elizabeth Moser. I am Brooke, and the funny thing is, we are all family. Elizabeth is Phil and Diane's daughter, so we're a family figuring this thing out together. We hope this podcast feels like you're sitting with us in our home talking about how to do this thing called life together. Elizabeth and I are your hosts. Let's get into this week's podcast. All right, on today's episode, I'm so excited about today. Today's really close to my heart personally, because we have Dr. Barry Gridley on the show. I'm going to introduce him in a minute when we get chatting, but what an incredible human. You're going to hear his story. We talk about trauma. We talk about dysfunctional family systems, what to do with shame, the four A's of things that come when we try to live from shame, and marriage as well. We cover so many things, but Barry has been a friend of mine for almost a year now. And a friend would be the wrong word. He's my therapist. He's my counselor. He's been so helpful in the arena of understanding so many different things about the inside of myself. And so I asked him to sit down and asked him just candidly if he'd have some honest conversations with us and put some microphones in front of us so we could actually share that with all of you. So I know you're going to enjoy today's episode, and please enjoy today's conversation with Dr. Barry Gridley. All right, so today, I know I just gave an intro, but today I'm here with Dr. Barry Gridley. Barry, Dr. Barry, what would you like me to call you for the rest of this episode?
You can call me Dr. Barry.
Dr. Barry, I like, yeah. Dr. Barry. Dr. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I'm so glad to have you. I'm going to give a little history. So one of my favorite things about today is that you are actually my therapist, which I'm so thankful for. And so thankful for your contribution, for your time that you've put into this. But oftentimes, I'm the one that is being asked questions of, and I'm on the other side. So I've been just waiting for today because I'm like, there's so many things I want to ask Barry. And now I get to today. So thank you for being game to do this.
Oh, you're very welcome. You're very welcome, Brooke.
It's very funny because a mutual friend of ours, Sally, she connected us, and I've just been so thankful for that connection. And I remember when we were talking to her one day, she's like, you need to talk to Barry. And I was like, oh, okay, well, who is this mysterious person? She's like, oh, no, Dr. Barry. I was like, okay, well, oh, obviously he's a doctor of some sort, medical or not. You know, she's like, no, he's a therapist. So I remember making the call, and it was in many ways really simple. You know, you make an appointment, but little did I know how much God was going to use you and your experience and your life to help me in so many different ways. And so I think if anything, I just want to express deep gratitude. And I don't think everyone always gets to do that with you, probably. I think in some ways they say thank you, for sure. But I don't think it's, you always get to see the impact of what you do.
Well, thank you very much for that, Brooke. It's a privilege. And we've worked on a lot of different things, but there's been a lot of fun and laughter in it too.
Yes, which I appreciate because, you know, that's not always the case. I'd love that you definitely do a good job of you know, taking the content seriously, but not taking yourself too seriously.
Yes.
So, but man, I can't wait to get into this conversation because there are so many things I am excited to pick your brain about specifically. But before we do that, I'd love to give people just like a backdrop, even just a word picture of your life. And so I know that obviously you have a wonderful wife, you have kids, you have grandkids, but would you introduce us to your family, and then we'll get into like all the details of what you've been doing professionally and
sure, in I'd ministry. Be glad to do that. Pamela and I have been married as of June 48 years together.
48.
We met in college and we married when we still knew it all at 19 and 20. fortunately, I have more amnesia about those early days than Pam does.
I do too. Elizabeth always remembers things I don't.
Yep. Yes. And so we waited 7 years to have our family start. And so we have a daughter, Amy, and her husband, Adam. They both teach public school up in Washington.
Okay.
And we have three grandchildren with them, Elijah, Isaiah, and Emma, 13, 11, and 9.
Wow.
And we also have a son who actually is at home as of the last 2 years. He worked for 13 years at Cannon Beach Christian Conference Center. And then when the 2020 layoffs due to COVID finally got to him, he's moved back in with us, and he works remotely from his room in our house, providing cell phone customer service for one of the cell phone carriers. So, and since he's our introvert, he's real easy to have around. And, you know, he contributes some rent and will often pick up, you know, groceries or something.
Yeah.
So it's been real easy to have him transition back while he's still kind of surveying what could really be next for him.
Wow.
So that's the nucleus of our family.
That's
There's the
family.
Eight of us.
Wow. Now, give us a history of how you, because you've done many things in your life, but I'd love to get a history of how you got into specifically marriage and family therapy. I know you focus on trauma, EMDR, all these wonderful things that if you're not familiar with those terms, they're wonderful, they're helpful. I remember the day when you explained to me that just like your body can heal when you break a bone, your brain can heal too. And I remember being completely relieved, blessed, overwhelmed, just not even recognizing that different layers and levels of trauma could actually be healed to an extent, right? Or,
yes.
or even sometimes fully depending upon what it is. And I remember the freedom that I felt that day, and freedom that I felt like, whoa, this is possible. And God's put people on the earth like you to figure this out with others and to study it and to pass that on. So, I mean, so many are so grateful for that. But how did you get started in all of this? And I know that you know, like we share a friend, Dr. Gary Brashears.
Yes.
I'd love to, I know it started way back there, but yeah, give us some history.
All right. Well, I'm a native Nebraskan. I was born and raised in Omaha. And as we all got into high school, I even back then was the kind of the kid that other kids would come and talk through problems with. Mm-hmm. And so looking back, there was those nudges and shapings even early then. It was in the fall of my senior year in high school where I came to know Christ as my Savior during the Jesus Freak movements of the late 60s, early 70s.
Yes. Yes.
Then I went off to college for a year and was really, really restless and came back home to Omaha, and there was a Christian university in town. And I thought, well, I'll take a year while I figure some things out,
mm-hmm.
and went there. And that's where I met my wife. And we ultimately finished there as I earned my degree. And while I was there, I really enjoyed studying the Greek New Testament. And so I wanted to learn Hebrew. And where do you do that? You go to seminary.
Yep.
And so I went to Western Seminary in Portland.
Yes.
And that was in the late 70s, early 80s. And as you mentioned, our good friend, Dr. Gary Brashears, I was his break-in class. So I tease Gary from time to time that the reason that went so well is because he had such a good first class at Western, and we broke him in right. That was also true for Dr. Carl Laney, who recently retired from Western too. I was in his first set of seminary classes.
I didn't make that connection. So you were actually there his first year of teaching the whole thing.
Yep.
Oh my goodness. Yep.
And
oh,
then wow. he was, well, as it ended up, both Dr. Laney and Gary Brashears, Dr. Brashears, were my readers on my Master of Theology thesis.
Oh, wow.
So there was a lot of working together, and I've stayed in touch with both of them over the years. Mm-hmm. In the process of earning that second degree from Western, God took me out to deal with some personal character issues. And that became a journey then where ultimately my wife and our family moved back to Nebraska for 10 years. And it was during that 10 years, first pastoring, and then through a unique set of circumstances, actually ending up initially part-time, and then for 6 years on staff at a residential drug and alcohol treatment center.
Wow.
And some of our good friends in that phase of our life were saying, you really need to develop this counseling. And so I went looking for further education in that and didn't really want to try to relocate the family at yeah. that point. And found the Denver Seminary Doctor of Ministry program in marriage and family. And so I earned that. And then since then, there's been kind of the weaving in and out, kind of like the Blue Angels at a naval air show. And I've pastored three churches. All three of those churches were on the other side of some kind of congregational explosion.
Wow.
So that was always interesting and hard at the same time. But as I've said to some folks, it was really very large group counseling and thinking about organizational health and how yeah. do I get people healthy. And then I've also been counseling in several different settings. I was 7 years at the drug and alcohol treatment center that I mentioned, and then I was 7 years in community mental health here in Central Oregon. For two of those years, I was director of the adult team of counselors. And wow. then I've been in private practice in the area for the last 5 years since leaving community mental health. And so I'm very, very thankful for the strong theological basis I got yes. while at Western. Mm-hmm. At one point, I had the privilege of being Dr. John Feinberg, one of the theologian professors. I got to be his teaching fellow for a year and wow. thought I would maybe follow him to Trinity and get a doctorate in wow. theology. But the Lord took us down other paths. Mm-hmm. And so as I said a moment ago, I'm just very thankful for the strong theological base and, yes. and training base that I had. And then, so that's how it's all gone.
You are enjoying content brought to you by Intentional, a crowdfunded nonprofit that desires to help families and marriages all around the world in the area of discipleship and spiritual formation. This offering is completely free, thanks to the generosity of our growing community of Legacy Builders. Legacy Builders is a group of people from all around the world that give monthly to fuel this dream that we have in our hearts of seeing discipleship to Jesus in the family become a way of life. A monthly gift of $5, $10, or even $30 can continue to fuel this ministry forward. Our dream is to invite people like you to join and partner with us at a financial level and see this work integrated into families. So as you listen to this podcast, would you prayerfully consider joining us? Would you allow the Spirit to lead you, even if it's just to a few dollars a month? Thank you so much, and may the Spirit of Jesus give you wisdom, clarity, and joy as you pray about joining us. And if you want to join today, go to intentionalparents.org and click on Give.
So as thank you for that quick snapshot. It's so interesting when I talk to people that are in your stage of life, how you can just be like, and then I was there for 10 years and I'm like, and then you just breeze past it, realizing that's a long time. That's a long time to be in one spot, a decade. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's people right now that are in the middle of their decade moments that, mm-hmm. you know, in hindsight, they're kind of like a blip. Could you give us just before I ask a little bit more history about, you know, working out the alcohol trauma center and that whole thing, would love to know just perspective on, like, give me your perspective on time now. Like, cause you're quick to just say that was a decade, right? But for the people that are listening right now, and they're in the middle of maybe a challenging marriage, the kids are really little and they're like, I feel like I have so much to contribute to the world, but I feel almost like I'm trapped and can't actually do the thing God made me to do. What would you say to those people, just as perspective, as you are in this age and stage of life?
I think one of the things I would say is have confidence that whatever season of like family life, for example, whether it's preschoolers or teenagers or empty nest, that that phase doesn't go on forever.
Yeah.
Even though when you're in the thick of it, it can feel like it does. Mm. And so I would also just say really develop the strong habit of one day at a time, because, and I know, people have heard this from grandparents that they've had in their lives. It really does go by a lot faster than you think it's going to. And yeah. Pam and I are a couple years away from 50 years of marriage, and we continue to look at each other and go, how in the world did that happen?
How have we done this for 50 years?
That's right. Wow. Exactly. So I think those would be two very simplistic things. Learn to enjoy and stay in the moment. And realize it is going to go by faster than you think it will when you're in a challenging season, like with teenagers or preschoolers. And, you know, the child that's not even 3 foot tall, but put hands on their hips and in the terrible twos is saying no.
Oh, and, I don't know what you're talking about, Barry.
Yeah,
oh, my goodness. We have one of those right now. And it's like insane, the level of ability to make grown humans cry. It's incredible how kids can do that. But give me, you know, something that you said, and I know you worked at an alcohol, drug, and treatment center. I'd love to ask where that came from for you. Cause obviously I know that you were working there, partly because that was a job, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. That was one angle.
Yep.
But maybe what's the backstory for you and where did that come from for you?
Well, the backstory is I grew up like 40 million Americans as a, in a home affected by alcoholism. Hmm. My dad was a World War II Navy vet, and like many of them, saw some awful things. I know part of his story was convoy duty in the North Atlantic.
Wow.
And so I am quite sure that he saw other members of a convoy get torpedoed by the German submarines, the U-boats.
Wow.
So
he was in the middle of that. He
would have
crazy.
Been at different times. Yes.
Wow.
And like most World War II vets, he didn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. So, his story was more of a binge drinking.
Okay.
He'd do really, really well and then not do well for a period of days or weeks or whatever. He was a successful insurance agent. In my hometown of Omaha.
Okay.
And so we...
So functional.
We had a, yeah, very, very, very functional.
Okay.
Yes. And grew up with assets and resources that a lot of families don't have. Hmm. But that meant that I, as the firstborn, took on some of the role of a hero. And, you know, achievement became my... marker in life as to how I was doing.
Yes.
And while Dad went to treatment pretty much every year in the 1960s, we never went as a family. And looking back on that, especially when I got started working at the Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center, I realized there were some things that happened that kept us sicker than we needed to be, kept us more in the pain of alcoholism than we needed to be. And really, the way I came about to work at the Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center was a mutual friend was working there one day a week as a chaplain, and they were needing to hire some more. And the job of the chaplain at that point at that particular treatment center was to take people through the 12 steps.
Wow.
And work with the small group leader and then the primary counselor. Mm-hmm. So they contacted me and... reached out on some things, and then another opportunity came up that was a little closer for them to hire someone else. That person was hired for 2 days and then got some teaching responsibility at the local parochial Catholic school.
Interesting.
So they came back to me.
Okay.
And so that's how I started 1 day a week. That lasted about a year. And then after that first year, I was able to come on staff full time.
Okay.
And spent the next 6 years there working with approximately 2,000 people, I suppose, wow, over those 7 years.
Oh my goodness. And this isn't, you know, this is impactful work. It's not just 2,000 people kind of acquaintances. This is
right.
Deep connections, deep help. Wow.
Right.
I'm just thinking about the families that lives are permanently altered in the positive way because of that. What a huge gift. You know, you started mentioning this, and I wasn't going to go there till later, but we're here. So I just want to go here. You started talking about some of the stuff that's been so helpful for me is understanding dysfunctional family systems. Am I saying that correctly? Is
yes.
that the right term?
Yep.
So I know that this can happen, and definitely I think a classic one is the home of the alcoholic parent, but that's not the only one. What are the no. other kind of things that can lead to dysfunctional family systems?
Well, obviously the one that our society is most familiar with, like you said, is the alcohol or the drug addiction impacted families.
Okay.
But other things can be, say, for example, if one of the parents has a chronic mental illness, like chronic depression.
Yeah.
Or chronic things that they need to be regularly treated for and taken out of the home.
Hmm.
So any debilitating sudden illness that changes the functioning of the family. So
would that include addiction as well? Like different addictions, maybe it's not alcohol or drugs, but like whether that's a sex addicted person or, I mean, drug addicted. Yeah. The, whatever
right.
the other, basically fill in the blank, but it's kind of like when something takes over
yes.
the family and it starts altering the behavior and the interaction. Am I understanding
yes.
that right?
Okay. Yeah. You're understanding that very well,
okay. Okay.
you know, but it can also be something like a parent that contracts, MS.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Because it disrupts the normal functioning of the family.
Okay.
And in a situation where there are chronic addiction or chronic mental health or a chronic life disrupting physical ailment, such as MS, the family has to adapt, but then they're never able to unadapt.
Yes.
And so yes. what happens is a role that they take on temporarily, let's say, over time, if they're not able to adjust and flex back to whatever the family was like before the MS or before the alcoholism started, then that role that they've taken becomes their identity.
Okay.
And that's where that becomes a problem for the individuals in the family. But the main thing that happens in families that are impacted by dysfunction is there's a high commitment to image management.
Okay.
We don't want to present the bad things.
Okay.
And so we do what we can to present a good public image or a good image, even with some of our friends. And so Claudia Black years ago in one of her books talked about the three rules of a dysfunctional family are
these are my favorite.
Don't talk, don't feel, and don't trust.
Yes.
You know, we don't talk about what's going on here. We don't feel, because it feels yucky, especially if you're growing up in that kind of environment, but you have adults telling you, no, it's not really as bad as you as a child are feeling it is. And so then you learn to disconnect from your emotions. And so that's where the don't trust comes yeah. in. And our family was really good at keeping all three of those rules.
Okay. So I have to talk to you about this on a deeper level, because so one of the things that's been very helpful for me with talking with you is understanding these systems, because I think we all, whether that's like understanding our own situation. So if you're listening to this and you're married, like how quickly or easily in some senses we could become dysfunctional. But then at the very same time, the things we experienced growing up, maybe putting language to it, which I know is my experience. And so I think even as you're talking, the don't trust, don't feel, don't talk, that piece even there has been so helpful, because the image management stuff, I know we were even talking about recently, how so much of what my subconscious is thinking, because I kind of grew up in this environment, is how I'm coming across to anybody at any time, at any moment. And it's not even something like I'm trying to do. It's not like I'm trying to have this, best foot forward type thing. It's just something that is seeming like almost hardwired. And I remember talking to you and I was like trying to explain a situation. And you're like, yeah, that's called image management. I'm like, wait, not that too. And you're like, yeah, no, it's that deep. It's that pervasive. And maybe give an example. I could give some from my own life too, but like give maybe a couple examples of what you mean, because I think someone might hear that and be like, well, does that mean you take care of your body, or you're only concerned about what you look like on Instagram, or what, give us an example of what image management can present like.
Well, image management is anything that a family that's impacted by a dysfunction, the alcoholism, the MS, the whatever it may be, it's what they do so that they lessen their individual and collective sense of shame. Shame meaning that I'm flawed, I'm defective, I'm the first mistake God ever made. And for all of us, shame feels yucky.
Yes.
And we don't like being ashamed. We don't like feeling exposed, because one of the traits of shame is I'm exposed in some area of weakness before the eyes or before the awareness of someone else. And so the image management is an effort on the part of the family to avoid feeling shame. And so one author calls it the glittering image. They mean they maintain the glittering image. And when I was first working at the Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center, I was reading one of the early books on adult children of alcoholics. And there was this sentence that said the number one rule in an alcoholic home is there's nothing wrong here and don't you dare talk about it. And when I read that, I started laughing. And I was reading it actually in bed, and my wife was almost asleep, and she cracked an eye open and looked at me, looked at the book and said, "What's so funny in that kind of book?" And I said, "This rule, I grew up with this. There's nothing wrong here and don't you dare tell anybody." And I've never seen the absurdity of it until I just now read it. And it was hysterical to me at the time. But that's an example of shame-based image management. We're okay, we're all doing fine. You know, this doesn't, it isn't as bad as it really seems. You know, those kind of things. So it's a lot of extreme minimizing, if you want to put it that way.
That's a good visual, extreme minimizing. Talk to us a little bit about shame, because man, I know that's a big one, so feel free to go as like as surface as you want, but I can't even begin to describe how much our I could be wrong, but especially in the Christian world, how shame is a mechanism for controlling people. And I don't even think it's, that's obviously not just in the Christian world, but I think it, there's overtones there, but how shame often presents itself and how we live really from postures of shame all the time. And maybe, you know, are not even fully aware of it. Do you have any, a couple thoughts on that, or you're smiling ear to ear on this?
Well, I think how I would start with that is with this. All of us come into the world as children wondering about two questions. Am I loved, and am I cared for, or said a little differently, am I safe? And those are hardwired into us. And you know, for those of your listeners who are astute about these things, this is part of what attachment theory is all based on. But none of us get those perfectly answered yes all of the time. And just like our parents who have us, they didn't get those two questions perfectly answered all of the time. And so that inconsistency, or in some cases, like trauma-impacted families, those are both answered no. And so what it creates is what I like to call the hole in the soul, because we're made to be loved. We need that as a survival mechanism. And so when we get mixed signals or signals that deny the fact that we're loved and or safe, that sets us on a quest. It sets us on a quest to find something that's going to fill up the hole in the soul. And what we don't realize is I have a hole in my soul. You have a hole in your soul. Everybody has a hole in their soul, because nobody since Genesis 3 has been perfectly loved and had both of those questions answered yes all of the time. And so typically what we do in trying to fill that hole in the soul, we try and go down the road of achievement and finding something that we're good at whether it's sales or athletics or mathematics or whatever, painting. Mm-hmm. We try and find something that we're good at, because achievement then and getting compliments and praise from other people for our sense of achievement can at least temporarily fill the hole in the soul.
Oh.
Or what can happen is if we internalize those mixed messages and begin to feel that profound sense of shame of, I am flawed, I am defective, this is my fault that this is going on, then that's where the various kinds of escapes can come in. And so there's three ways that are pretty classic escapes. One is the one of addiction. Mm-hmm. Another is the one of, and I'll give you the three A's just for, because they're easy to remember.
Yes.
So addiction, adultery, and adrenaline. Oh, so we go into some addiction in order to numb ourselves.
Okay.
Or we go into some sort of sexual pursuit, pleasure, immorality, pornography, because that at least temporarily numbs that hole in the soul. Okay. Or we go to risk-taking behaviors. Mm-hmm. So, for example, bungee jumping, which you don't ever have to worry, Brooke, about me ever going bungee. Yeah,
well,
no,
I just
thank
didn't
you.
Know if you wanted to, because if you did, I would go with you right
there,
away.
There you
I'm
are.
Trying to avoid a lot of stuff right
That's
now.
That's right. So all of those are ways of, in one sense, numbing.
Yeah.
In one sense, disconnecting from that empty hole in the soul. And if achievement doesn't do it, then we typically go down the path of try harder.
Hmm.
Or we can move then toward giving up and drift into one of those three A's, the adultery, the addiction, or the adrenaline outlet.
Well, you really just said four. You got the achievement.
Oh, yes, the achievement, the four A's.
The four A's. So if it's not achievement, then it's addiction, adultery, and adrenaline.
Yep.
That is fascinating to me. And I have so many other questions, which I won't ask all here. But I do have to say that, or maybe just an observation, which I think you said, but just to wrap back on it, is what I hear you saying is that we have a hole in our soul, obviously. I would completely agree with you on that. And that a lot of shame is born from that place.
Yes.
And then we all kind of try to deal with that in different ways, various ways. And would you say, because I think it's easy for some people to listen and be like, well, I'm not necessarily living from shame. But here's the thing I've learned about shame is it's very sneaky. It's foundational in many ways. It's almost like bedrock built into how we move through the world, and are almost like, it's like when you're asking a fish, or like, are you swimming in water? And it's like, what's water? That kind of idea, mm-hmm. that it's kind of in the makeup of our world and our being. And so for those who are maybe sitting here going, I don't really deal with shame. I just want to highlight, like, observe those four A's. Where are you trying to avoid shame by achievement? Where is it, you know, addiction,
adultery,
addiction,
and adrenaline.
Wow. Wow. That's really helpful. So coming back, like looping back, thank you for going there with me for a minute.
You're welcome.
Looping back to the dysfunctional family systems, you had said you started playing a role, and I'd love to just talk about really quick before we talk about trauma and marriage and all those other fun things, where we end up, how those actually play out. So if you have a dysfunctional family system, because my suspicion is that a lot of people listening have either, healthy families that didn't have that, or they had dysfunctional family systems, and they maybe haven't been able to put words to it. And I know for me personally, as we got into my own life and own story and own family and all that stuff, you just helped me see things as they really were. And I just realized I hadn't been able to see them that way, which I think is the gift of a gifted counselor. But I also know that just having language and understanding just like took the air out of the tire, like, oh, this makes so much more sense. And so maybe could you give us a little bit of what happens in those dysfunctional families and the different roles that are usually, you know, general terms are represented?
Sure. Be glad to do that. So let's start by thinking of what happens in a normal, regular functioning family.
Okay.
Let's say that the dad is Bill and he's in his 40s and the mom is Martha.
Okay.
And then they have a teenager, a preteen, and then a grade schooler. They have Sam, who's 16 and driving. They have Sarah, who's 14, and then they have Sammy, or Sammy, who is let's make Sammy 10. Well, let's say unexpectedly Dad has a heart attack. And so Dad has to go to the hospital and in his ICU for a while. And so their normal routine obviously is disrupted. Mm-hmm. So what happens? So the three kids and mom divide up chores. So like maybe the son says, hey, I can drop, you know, my brother and sister off at school. You don't have to do that, mom. And maybe Sarah says, I can cook dinner three nights a week so that you can go and stay longer at the hospital with Dad or whatever. So they flex and they take on a role to help get the family through this time of Dad's heart attack. Well, and then Dad comes back and maybe he needs to only work part-time for a while. So they stay helping with those roles. But eventually Dad is back. He's healthy. He's doing the things that he could do. So then at that point, they go back to what they were doing before they filled in these roles to divide up what needed to be taken place. In a dysfunctional family, in a chronic disease family, in a family impacted by mental health, a family affected by domestic violence, people take on a role, but they're never able to not be in that role. And so what happens over time, that role becomes their identity. And so in my case, as a firstborn and as a firstborn son, I gravitated toward being the hero. And one of the things that the hero does is it provides the family a sense of self-esteem. Things may be bad, but look how good Barry is doing at this or that or the other thing.
Okay.
So that can be one role. Another one is the lost child, the child that gets overlooked in the midst of all of the chaos, or a child that makes a deliberate choice to withdraw from the chaos. I had one of my family members in my home growing up that was what that family member did, lived quite a lot in the bedroom and just
disconnected
as a way of getting through some of those kinds of things. Sometimes a child or a teen in that environment will act out all their anger and they'll get in trouble for maybe MIPs or other, you know, different ways of acting out anger. And so they're identified as the scapegoat. They're expressing the family pain in outward behaviors, and yet they are also the ones who get the negative attention from the family because they're messing up, and because they're messing up, they're not maintaining the glittering image.
Yes.
They're breaking all of those image behaviors, and they are talking, they are feeling, they are they are trusting. And what's interesting,
like, no, we don't do this.
That's right. Exactly. So they get a lot of blame from the family itself, let alone from maybe the being on probation because of petty shoplifting or whatever it is. But it's oftentimes those folks that get the help first because they are acting out and they come into systems that help them with counseling or whatever it may be. So you have that one. Another one is the clown. The person who just says, the way I'm going to get through this is I'm going to find the silliness in life. I can find the humor in things. And if you do a study of many, many popular comedians, they come from some pretty messed up backgrounds, and that's where they have ended up. And sadly, for some of those folks, they've ended in suicide.
Ironically, a lot of them.
Well, because what happens there oftentimes, and this I realize this is simplistic to say, but they aren't seen as a real person. They're only known as the one with the funny joke or the life of the party or whatever, but they're never taken serious.
Their whole personhood.
So they're always siloed, if you will, in that role of a comedian. And that works for a while. But again, there's a difference between taking on a role, like when the dad has the heart attack, versus getting locked into that role as an identity.
Hmm.
And so, again, comedy works for the clown for a while, but then they want to be seen for who they really are.
Yes.
And then there's also typically the one who keeps the sickness going. Classically within the alcoholic family, that's called the enabler, the one who covers for things in our family system. Because my mom and dad owned an insurance agency together, I can remember being fifth grade or so, and my mom saying, okay, I'm going down to the office now. I'm going to do some paperwork. And this would be about bedtime, 8:30, 9 o'clock.
Okay.
And so she would go down and do paperwork that dad wasn't doing when he was off in one of his addiction binges. And, you know, she would come home after midnight, but she would say, okay, I'm going to be down at the office. You can call me if anything, you know. Well, I didn't think about that, you know, in the context of everything else that was going on for us. But in essence, by doing that, dad could be more irresponsible because she was covering some of the bases.
It didn't affect the actual life. There's no real consequence for the behavior. Oh, wow. So that's how it showed up for you and your family. And at the time, was your mom just like, well, I'm just going to go get some work done? It was kind of in that category.
It was that very matter of fact.
Yeah. But in reality, she wouldn't have had to do that work if your dad wasn't binge drinking. And,
exactly.
Oh, man. And then did your parents stay married?
No, they didn't. They divorced when I was 16 years old.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. I had actually been, if I could put it this way, lobbying for that for a couple of years.
Okay.
And because I just thought this amount of craziness is nuts. Why do we need to, you know, to endure this, put up with it? But I know the reason mom dragged her feet was she really did love dad. Mm-hmm. And it didn't start out that way. So I think she had to get to the point where she could see the deleterious effects of the binging and the disruption to the family.
Wow.
So what I wasn't prepared for was the depression that I came into when that happened, because unfortunately, to some extent, my family, when we were with mom, there would be times where she'd bad talk dad. And if we were with dad, he would bad talk mom. And that isn't how I envision that. Now, there wasn't a lot of that, but especially early on. And so, yeah, I went into a pretty significant depression during the fall of my sophomore year in high school.
Wow.
Which would have been about 10 months into their being divorced and dad out of the house and all of that.
Yeah. As a person who sits with people all the time in the arena of divorce, I'm sure, I mean, I don't know the exact stories, but obviously in your line of work, I'm sure you connect with and talk with a lot of people that are either contemplating divorce, in divorce. What is the thing that you see in your opinion? This is just Dr. Barry sitting down like, here's my, I don't know how clinical this is or isn't, but this is what I see. What is your opinion of the hardest part of divorce? Like, where is the most damage caused in that arena? In your experience, where do you see that come up? Because right now I'm hearing you say your parents got divorced because there was a bunch of messed up stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure in one sense, your parents were aware, like, this isn't great for the kids. I could also see how they're saying things like, but, you know, crazy isn't good, so let's pick the lesser of two evils. But there's side effects to all that stuff. One, some of the cataclysmic feelings that you started feeling or not feeling, depression, all that type of stuff. So what is some of the stuff that you have seen? Where do you see divorce causing the most damage in the line of work that you do?
Well, one of the things is what I alluded to a little bit ago, is that when children are with one parent, for that parent to badmouth the other parent and then to have the same thing happen, especially, of course, in joint custody where there may be one weekend and then split up the week or every other week, whatever the situation is. Because, again, as we know, children are wired to love mom and dad, even yeah. to love mom and dad, who are the cruelest, most neglectful or whatever, they want that relationship with mom and dad. Mm. So it's very disrupting to have a child hear parents who supposedly used to love each other run each other down, because then that erodes that child's place of safety. Mm-hmm. It erodes their connection. There are things that can go along with that, like using a child to be the messenger back and forth between the two parents instead of directly talking with each other. So those are some of the things that happen. When a child is younger, just strictly from a brain development standpoint, we know that the ability to do, say, cause and effect reasoning doesn't happen until 12, 13, 14 as the brain's developing. So one of the damaging things is a child will go toward magical thinking. Hmm. And so a child, like all of us, does not like to feel powerless.
Okay.
And a child in a home where parents are divorcing is definitely powerless. But they will say, the reason that mommy and daddy are getting a divorce is because I'm not good at math. Because that gives them something that they feel they can control. Hmm. And they'll put effort into, because that gives them hope. Now, of course, mommy and daddy are not getting divorced because Susie is no good at math. Or only a C student in math.
Yeah, of course.
But that's a way of making sense out of an environment that they can't have impact in. Mm. And, you know, that magical thinking is, in fact, you know, what makes childhood so wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, we've all imagined, you know, in my day, it was Davy Crockett. Mm. It was some of the Westerns that were on TV yes. in the 50s and 60s. So the imagination and the ability to play and take on those roles is part of that magical thinking. But in a situation like I was just describing, it's doomed to failure, which then will increase the child's sense of impotence or voicelessness or disconnect from both parents, or that word that we've talked so much about already, shame.
If you're enjoying this content and you want to go deeper, we have an amazing resource that we want to tell you about. It's the Intentional Film Series, Raising Passionate Jesus Followers. Now, this is an incredible tool for you for spiritual formation in the family. And we created this film series to help parents in their God-given task to raise and disciple their own children. Now, our hope is that we're able to help you and give you some of the tools that I know we so desperately need, as we're in the process of raising our kids, and Phil and Diane have actually raised their kids. This is a 9-session film series on the process of what raising a passionate Jesus follower actually looks like. There's some workable solutions in here. There's a bunch of wisdom from the scriptures, and there's a bunch of practical help in your journey as you are raising your children. We cover all sorts of things like parental roles, goals versus values. What is discipline versus punishment? How do I create a heart of obedience in my child where they actually want to obey? What does a heart of self-control look like? Or how do I even help my child in the process of character development? We cover that and so many more things. You can use this film series in a variety of ways. You can use it at your home, preferably with your spouse if that's applicable, with a group of friends or in your community, or even through your local church. All you need to do is head over to our website, intentionalparents.org, click on film series, and then follow the prompts. We have a bunch of other resources there that you can check out, but we do pray that this blesses you in your pursuit of raising passionate Jesus followers. And that leads me into the next thing I really do want to talk about, because I know you have you specialize in trauma and trauma therapy. And for those, I know we've talked about this topic for sure on the podcast before, but I also think I am always just surprised by the amount of people that experience different levels of trauma. I think in one way or another, I mean, collective trauma through 2020 and 2021. Mm-hmm. And but I also think that there's a lot of people that experience it and either undermine it or minimize is a better word. We do some of that dysfunctional family stuff. We pretend it's not real or it didn't happen. But maybe just could you give us a heads up of what trauma is and how it really does impact us and how it impacts our living and what we can and honestly can't do, even though we're aware or not aware of it.
Okay. So a really simple way of thinking about trauma is trauma overwhelms our ability to cope. It overwhelms our ability to process, respond to, make sense of something.
Okay.
So, it's different than simply having a skills gap.
Okay.
A skills gap would be like a family that needs to learn how to have a budget and stick to a budget. There's a gap between how they know to manage finances, but that gap can be improved upon by learning some things so that the challenge of running a home with a budget is matched by their understanding of how to have a budget and how to keep good financial records and things that way.
Okay.
Trauma, on the other hand, on a deeply personal level, overwhelms whatever coping skills we have. It overwhelms us emotionally. It overwhelms us in how do we even think about this. It overwhelms us in disconnecting us from other people because of hurt.
Yep.
It certainly impacts us spiritually.
Oh, yes. Yes.
In that whole realm. And so trauma really is something that we really don't know how to absorb and to make sense of. And it paralyzes us in some ways to being able to respond, because whether it's a one-time event, which those of us who are connected to the eye movement desensitizing and reprocessing community, we call those big trauma events. Like a dad who drops dead of a heart attack unexpectedly.
Absolutely.
Or like Pamela and I had happen back in 1978 when United Flight 178 crash landed in our backyard.
Wait, hold on. Pause the trauma talk. We're going to get, you said big T trauma last, what?
We were.
You said that way too passively. You had a plane crash in your backyard?
We were living on 157th and Burnside, the main north-south dividing street in Portland, during our seminary years. And December the 28th of 1978, Flight 178 United basically ran out of fuel because they had a light that was saying their landing gear wasn't down, and they circled too big a circle because they thought they were going to come in belly landing, at Portland International. And they ran out of gas.
What?
And so they crashed into our neighborhood. And if you stand basically by your front hallway there and put a DC-8 in the middle of your street. I have one of my friends, a fellow seminarian, was actually on the plane. So, but that's an example of a one-time big T event.
So let me ask a question with that. Did anyone, I love how that was just so passive. I like when that one time the plane crashed in our backyard. Anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But so tell me though, what did people survive? Did everyone survive?
10 people were killed.
10 people. Oh my goodness.
10 people were killed, 2 of the flight crew and 8 people all in first class.
Wow.
So the way that it crashed and okay.
Mm-hmm. So your friend survived?
Yes.
Okay, your friend survived.
Yes.
Wow. So you were like on the scene.
Actually, I was at work that night, but Pam was able to get a hold of me, and I came home and so yes. And then when we woke up the next morning in the sunlight, we could see really just how close it was, because it happened at 6 o'clock at night. So it was already dark in December.
But wow. And did it, obviously destroy homes in the neighborhood? And
it flattened one home on the south side of the street. Yes. But the part that when it crossed on the north side of Burnside, it was in a grove of trees.
Oh my goodness.
It was an interesting moment.
So that was a big T.
Yes, that's a big T event.
Got it.
Okay, so a little T would be like a child that's perpetually played picked last at kickball.
Oh yes, okay.
Okay, or a child that's particular every night goes home hungry.
Interesting.
Goes to bed hungry. So little T's are things that happen regularly. And one of the ways you can evaluate the impact of a trauma is frequency, intensity, duration, and proximity.
Okay.
So was the trauma frequent? So that's one of the criteria for, is it a big T trauma because it only happened once, or is it a little T because it was ongoing?
Yeah.
Intensity, you know, a family that through mismanagement of money goes hungry for a Sunday night, Monday morning till they can go to the grocery store. Yeah. That's low intensity. Childhood sexual abuse that's happening every single night. That's high intensity. Duration, was it a one-time thing like United Flight 178, or did it go on for years?
Wow.
And then proximity, how close were you involved with whatever the thing was?
Yes.
So we were closely involved with the airplane crash, but my friend Buzz was much more involved with it because he was on the plane that night.
Wow.
And so those are just four ways of thinking about how intense and how soul damaging is the trauma.
Wow. So when you're, that's really insightful. I'm thinking of people taking some of this as like a grid, Gridley, what a great last name. But taking this, you know, those four things and applying it over to their life, right? Because I think that's actually what we, you know, when we hear things like that, we often take our story and go, okay, well, what was my situation? How often and frequency, intensity, all that. As people are doing that, whether that's fully conscious or not, what would you say, like if someone kind of is answering those questions and maybe even coming aware right now, like, whoa, I think I actually have experienced trauma. What do you encourage that person to do? I mean, I would have some guesses given your profession, but what would you encourage somebody that has experienced trauma to do, even if they can't get into a therapist or can't get into a counselor or get help right away? What's some things we can do as we notice that?
Well, one of the ways that trauma shows up, of course, is physically in our body because it just overwhelms our senses. Mm-hmm. So I encourage people to practice what I call just the basics of stress management, because trauma is extremely heightened stress. And so the basics of stress management all come down to, what are you eating? How well are you sleeping? Are you exercising? Or I prefer the word moving. Moving yeah. sounds much better than exercising. What are you doing for fun?
Okay.
What are your spiritual habits like? And what are you doing in our society to disconnect and unplug from the phone, the net streaming,
yes.
all of those different kinds of things.
Yes.
And so in those big categories, everything else becomes a technique.
Okay.
Keto diet is a technique for how you eat. A spin class is a technique for moving. You know, a regular family card game night is a technique for having fun. So
yes.
you want to make sure that you're paying attention to those basic areas. And if any of those areas need attention, say, for example, insomnia,
yeah,
to do what you need to do to help that taken care of. One of the things that trauma does is it isolates us. Because it feels like no one else has been through what I've been through. No one else is going to understand, which is why the whole movement of 12-step groups, recovery groups, there were sociologists that said the greatest social invention of the 20th century was AA, because yeah. it broke down that sense of isolation.
Interesting.
And gave people permission in a safe place to talk about their life struggles.
Yes.
So I think that's an important piece of it too, is to find one or two people that you can tell your story to.
Yes.
because part of even just telling the story drains off some of the emotional, mental, spiritual, relational damage and breaks that isolation. Because trauma isolates.
It's almost like Jesus had some real wisdom to impart when it comes to especially community, that a community matters and having those people in your life that you can be honest with. I'm just, you know, even thinking of as you're talking about all this right now and even the arena of trauma, how I think it's easy to underestimate, I say this to you all the time, I know, but how tiring trauma and grief are. There's things I've been grieving for years and still have to grieve. And I'm always talking to you about this, like I'm so emotionally exhausted and you're constantly helping me see like, yeah, because you're grieving stuff. And yeah, because this is how trauma impacts you. And so I mean, I've been doing this work in the sense of like being aware of this, starting the conversations, being present, like doing this for as long, I think it was like 7 or 8 years. I've been doing this deep work and it's been ongoing and consistent. And I still am completely surprised by how the emotional, physical toll that trauma plays in our lives. And I never give it its adequate space or its adequate. I often go, well, it's not that big of a deal. You know, we undermine it or kind of just minimize is a better word. I minimize a lot of that stuff. So, yeah. So how big of a deal is trauma? So like, in your opinion, like, is it really not that big of a deal or is it really a big deal?
Trauma is a huge deal because, as I said a moment ago, it isolates us from other people because nobody's going to understand what I've been through, plus the shame of whatever the debilitating event was gets in the way of that. It takes a lot of mental, emotional, and social energy to keep up the appearance, the glittering image. And that's draining. Trauma brings grief because oftentimes, especially with big T trauma, there's a distinct before and after.
Yes.
And you have to do grief work of what the trauma has cost you, the trauma's impact, because as I like to say, you have to grieve what you've lost in order to make room for what can still happen in your life.
Yes. Finish that and, yeah, I have a question.
And so most people do not realize how draining grief work is. And as you know, one of my favorite words for grief is that it ambushes us.
Yes.
Because I can't say to somebody who comes to me wanting to do grief work over the loss of a family member, I can't say to them, okay, Joan, here's what I want you to do. Every Sunday at 3:00 in the afternoon, I want you to have a good cry about this. It doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't. You're right.
You don't know what will trigger it. And even something that hasn't triggered it previously may trigger it, you know, in an unexpected moment. So it contributes a sense of wildness, which contributes to us feeling out of control.
Yes.
And we don't like feeling out of control.
No.
It is mysterious.
Yes.
You know, I tell the story to some of my clients. You know that I've had 2 family members complete suicides. And one of those was at Christmas time. And we buried that particular family member, my father, on Christmas Eve morning. I thought that first Christmas a year later would be tough. And it really wasn't. But it was year 17. And year 17, I was a mess.
Really?
And I have no idea why. As I was going through it, the son part of me just realized that I'm feeling it this year in ways I've never felt it before in 16 years.
Yeah.
The counselor part of me was going, what? What is going on?
I know better than this.
And I never had my moment of clarity as to what made that year number 17 so much intense compared to the others. And that's been more than 17 years ago now. So that's just on a personal story level. We get ambushed by it and we don't always know why.
So grief work, something that's kind of in my mind is, how do we actually then grieve? Because you're saying grief work. And I know we've talked about this a little bit, but I would love to talk about how do we actually properly grieve? And again, you said it ambushes. And I would say, before you answer that question, I experience this all the time where I'm just so surprised by a feeling that just overtakes me. But I'm like, what happened? Like, everything's normal. We've planned a normal day. There's nothing crazy. And so, yeah, how do we do this grief work? And how do we maybe make space or permission for the ambushes of grief?
I think one of the things that America is not good at doing is entering into emotional pain.
Oh,
and
that's good.
Be able to say, this hurts. This memory hurts. This unfulfilled relationship hurts. This diagnosis hurts, whatever the situation may be. And then we know that grief has its different phases to it. And, you know, we probably don't need to take the time to go into that, but it's not just one dimensional. There can be anger. There can be that aloneness. There can be that numbness and not knowing what to say about it. There can be, you know, that overwhelming sadness. There can be the experience of life is never going to be the same again, and I'm never going to be the same person again, and all of those different things. And I think the starting point is to give us permission to tell ourselves, I am feeling what I'm feeling. And as unpleasant as this is, and how we like to run from unpleasantness, that to feel this ambushing, to feel this complexity of emotion, because when I talk with clients about the different dimensions of grief, I explain it's more like playing a pinball game, whether a video game or on a real coin operated machine, up, down, sideways, diagonally, up and around. And so it's not like crossing off, okay, we bought the apples already in the grocery store, and now we're going to get the Tide laundry detergent. And that's what contributes to its wildness and its unpredictability. So the first part of it is being able to say, I'm doing grief work in this moment. And I don't like it necessarily, but it's normal. And that normalcy includes it's unpleasant. And yet at the same time to say, this will not go on forever. And I can, as I resist suppressing it or pushing it away or escaping into some kind of addiction or numbing behaviors, I will start to have things fall into place again. Going back to some of what we've talked earlier in our conversation today, finding some people that you're not in isolation with that grief in. That's one of the, again, Grief Share is a really great program that's out there that's found in many different community groups. And there are other grief-based organizations that can help take some of the mystery and some of the isolation and some of the hopelessness out of somebody who's in the throes of grief work. The other thing I'd want to say about grief work too, Brooke, is that it's not just death-related. You're going to do grief work if you get fired from a job.
Okay.
You're going to get grief work if you've gotten a promotion, but the promotion means that you and your family need to move across country. You're going to be doing grief work because you're not going to be able to eat at your favorite restaurants anymore, or your kids' best friends are no longer going to be right across the street.
Yeah.
And one of the things about us as people is we always experience change first as loss, like I just described.
Yep.
And then we get excited about the adventure of moving to Madison, Wisconsin, or Lincoln, Nebraska, or Ashland, Oregon.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd want to live in any of those places, but I can't say that I would know the, you know, Nebraska enough to say that I wouldn't. But yeah, you're right. There is that. I think there's also personalities. I know even myself, mm-hmm. it's easy to be like, well, I'm losing this, but you jump to the excitement to deal with the disappointment.
Yes.
You almost deal with it by reframing it and be like, well, it's going to be okay that I lost all this because I'm getting all this.
Well, and the other reality, because you mentioned personalities, you know, introverts versus extroverts, they're going to two different ways of grieving. Those who are highly empathetic are going to grieve as opposed to those who are more logical. So all of those different things that make up our unique personalities shape how we grieve. And oftentimes families turn on one another because they're not grieving the same way. So you're not doing it right because you're not doing it like I am. And then you have not only grief work, but then you have family conflict because
creating more trauma, creating more grief. Okay. So you're leading there perfectly. And this is where I want to end today, but I also think it's insanely important. There's inevitably going to be couples listening where one or both experienced big T trauma, little T trauma, both potentially. And one is moving through the world in a way that is not as healthy as the other one. And I know for a long time, I was unaware of the trauma for me and the trauma I went through growing up in different various things. So Elizabeth kind of was going on with life and she was doing way better than I was. It was just normal everyday stuff. But I just couldn't for the life of me figure out why. Now I knew I married somebody that was out of my league and far better than me and all this stuff. I get all of that. And honey, if you're listening, you're welcome and I love you. But I also think that it was way more than that. I was like, she has something or that I don't have, and I don't know what it is. And it was really hard to figure that out for a while. But it does that. It creates a ton of like, and even her lack of understanding of what I was going through, because I didn't know either. It's like, what's wrong with you? Like, I was like, I don't know what's wrong with me. So kind of pivoting a little bit, we've got grief, we've got trauma, we've got dysfunctional families. You also specialize in marriage, right? And specialize in helping couples in their marriages. I don't really have a clear question, but how does this all play out in our marriages and what can we do to be aware of how this impacts us and how can we be gracious and loving and not tear each other apart and come together in the process? Maybe that's a great launching point question, or I don't have an exact one, but take that from where you want it.
Well, I think the first thing is, again, even within marriage, breaking the natural tendency to stay silent about some of our suffering. And being able to take the risk to tell our spouse or partner what's happened to us along in life's journey. Because emotional bonds are some of the strongest bonds in a marriage. And being able to talk about our stories and to talk about this is where people failed me, or this is where I failed people, or this is this big event that happened in my life and I don't feel like I've ever really gotten back to being me since then. So I think breaking the silence that isolation and trauma often imposes upon us.
Okay.
The other piece of it is recovery from trauma, generally speaking, is going to take longer than most of us want it to. And so it's going to require a lot of patience, a lot of recognizing that trauma work typically ebbs and flows, that there can be a time where it seems a lot of significant growth is happening, and then that growth needs to be consolidated, and it can seem like there's not much happening at all, and a tendency at times to revert back to the old behaviors that the person is trying to change. So it's going to require on the non-traumatized partner's role a lot of patience, a lot of kindness. And again, I think the other piece is they both need to be in some sort of supportive group, whether it's a betrayal group, say with sexual addiction or AA and Al-Anon or various kinds of support groups, parents without partners for those who have had, you know, the death of a partner, and are solo parenting by the seat of their pants, it can feel like. Those are some of the starting points, at least. And also to realize, if I've not been impacted by trauma, but my wife has, there's going to be ongoing seasons of grief and getting ambushed by grief. And when they're processing anger, or when they're numb because they feel like they've talked about it 102 times before and don't have anything more to say, not to take it personally, you know, not to own that you're necessarily doing something wrong in the marriage, although there are mistakes you can make in the marriage by further shaming them about their reactions to the trauma. So those are just some of the things, but really that's a big area that maybe we can come back to and talk another podcast.
This is, that's all I wanted to do is whet everyone's appetite, because I can't wait to have more conversations about that specifically. I just wanted to leave us with one thing. You've been alive for longer than myself and most people listening. Not all, though, because we have our growing crew of people that are intentional grandparents, which is rad. But I do want to ask, like, if you were to deposit something into us, like, it doesn't have to be on any of the topics that we talked about, but you see and you think and your job is to help people to understand these things and then to give those things away. What's one thing that you would want to leave with us today that can be simple, that can be complex, something you've been stirring over? I know that I don't want to tease everybody, but I know you're writing some things, which I can't wait about, which I won't overshare with that, but I can't wait until some of that comes out. And we'll make sure when that does come out, we'll definitely share that with people. But I would just love to know, like, what would you love to deposit, if anything? And this is on the spot. So if you need like a minute if you're like, hey, I need a minute, that's totally fine too.
Well, I think one of the things that we talked briefly about early is that no season lasts forever. And so you need to hold on to that, especially in the hard seasons of life, like teething or the terrible twos or the parent being scared to death when their child finally gets their driver's license. So that's one thing I would say. And then I really think coming at it, as you know that I do, from a faith component.
Yes.
God can be trusted. I think that's just important to speak even into the midst of trauma, and when we're crying out for perspective and we're living with mystery, God can be trusted.
Yes.
And the pains and brokenness of life drive us back to what I hope people rethink, which is one, the character of God and the names of God by which he helps us know how to relate to him. And then I think the other thing, and we maybe haven't talked enough about this, we've got to be able to laugh. We've got to be able to have humor. I had someone teasingly say to me one time, if we take life too seriously, we'll never get out of it alive.
You always have these one lines that you have so many one lines. That's just one of so many I've heard from you before, but that's a really good one. That's a really good, but I so agree. Like, how often do we get stuck because we're taking the situation, the moment too seriously,
or ourselves too seriously?
Ourselves. Yeah. Primarily ourselves. I think
another one of my one liners would be, you need to learn to laugh at yourself because other people already are.
Yes. Yeah. Such truth. I mean, such simple truth. Oh, well, what a pleasure it has been to talk with you today, Dr. Barry. Thank you for taking the time and depositing into me, and for all the work that you do, and for all the people that haven't been able to thank you for the ongoing change of life. Just want to join the masses of saying thank you for what you do, and keep up the good work. I pray that God will continue to give you energy and wisdom and discernment in many more years to do what you're doing, because it's a huge gift.
Thank you very much, Brooke. It's been fun to be with you today. I look forward to doing this perhaps in the future, not too far away, I hope.
No, it will be soon. I promise.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If this podcast has blessed you in any way, here's a few ways that you can partner with us in this ministry. First is to give. Intentional Parents is a nonprofit, and we rely on the generous giving of our partners. So please head over to our website, intentionalparents.org/give, if you would like to become one of our partners through giving. Second is to share it. If this has at all been helpful to you, we encourage you to share it with your friends, your family, and those that you know would be blessed by it. Third is to follow us on social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. You can find us on Instagram @intentional_parents. And lastly, if you would head over to iTunes, if you enjoyed today's episode, and leave a review on iTunes, this helps us bring more hope, help, and healing for families.